Welcome to Talking Book Publishing.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Book Publishing. I'm Kathleen Kaiser, your co-host, along with Adana Moriarty. And today we have a really interesting guest. He's a scientist, a geologist, and an explorer who's just released a memoir about his first expedition to Antarctica, Bruce Leyendyk. So welcome, Bruce. I was so intrigued with your book because, frankly, I've never really thought much about Antarctica. And I was wondering, like, what sparked your interest in researching or studying Antarctica?
It happened, like many interesting things, by accident. I had, when I was in college, I took a research assistant job on a sabbatical or a pause from college. I worked at a place called Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and I met people there. I would hang out with and have lunch with, and one day somebody mentioned a book about Ernest Shackleton, and I said, "Who's he?" And I was in college, and I did not know who Shackleton was. So people around the table shamed me for being, you know, going to college and not knowing this. And then they started telling me the story about that remarkable rescue of how Shackleton rescued his marooned crew in 1916 on the Antarctic Peninsula. And I knew enough about what that would take that it was just really floored me, it shocked me. And I remembered that incident. And then a few years later, when I was working, maybe 10 or 15 years later, when I was working at UC Santa Barbara, I went to a local library, and by accident, I found the book that Shackleton had written about this expedition. And I read it, and I just thought it was so powerful, and it was just so magnetic to me, that it just stuck in my mind. And it became more real than even the first time I heard it. Well, what followed after that was a colleague of mine, Dave, who's in the book, Mighty Bad Land. We started a project in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, we were studying mountain ranges there and their origins. And we're being frustrated by access and how hard they were to get to, and how weathered they were from all the constant rain and chemical degradations. And Dave suggested, well, you know, there's mountains like this in Antarctica. We should go there and discover them, work on them there. And I thought that was brilliant. And I said, yeah, let's do that. So from there, 2 years later, we ended up in those mountains in Antarctica because we thought about it when we were working on the mountains in New Zealand.
Well, that's because, you know, what I'm going to maybe skip around a little here, but move forward. But one of the things that you reveal in the book is that you were one of the first people to come up or discover Zealandia, which is actually the eighth, continent. It's mostly submerged except for New Zealand. So is that why some of the mountains in Antarctica, from geology, from that point of view, the same as New Zealand?
Yes, short answer is yes, is that the ancient supercontinent Gondwana, when it existed, included Antarctica, New Zealand, India, Australia, a bunch of continents all glued. They weren't continents yet, they were all one piece. So the creation of the mountains in Antarctica, in Murray Birdland, and the creation of the mountains that we studied in New Zealand are tied to the same event. And that was our hypothesis we were trying to test, was actually whether those two mountain ranges were once tied and part of Gondwana. And since Gondwana broke up into pieces, the pieces that drifted north, some of them stayed above sea level and some of them sunk below sea level. So there's, but they were all were part of Gondwana originally, a supercontinent.
So did, I mean, you had that hypothesis before you went to Antarctica, like when you guys were in New Zealand, you were already like working on that theory. Is that, or did you figure that out when you went to Antarctica?
The latter. What we were more, what we were zeroing in when we kind of launched the project idea was whether the mountain ranges in New Zealand and the ones that were known in a very sketchy manner in Marie Birdland were of the same genesis, and whether they matched up in both geography and history. I mean, think of it as Gondwana is a newspaper, and you've got writing across it, and then you tear it apart. So you've got sentences on one piece of the newspaper and sentences on the other piece of the newspaper. Are they the same sentences, and can you make them align, line up? So then you can say, therefore, ah, look at that. They were once together, right there, right at that spot. So that's the, what we started to try to answer that question. Were they together? Were they at that spot, at the same spot? Did they evolve the same way? And after that fact, when I was looking at the aftermath of that split up, I recognized, because it was obvious once you see all the pieces, that it's a puzzle that can be put back together. So the Zealandia pieces are pieces of the puzzle that are distributed, and you can move them back up against Antarctica and make Gondwana, that part of Gondwana. So that was after the fact, after we had come to a pretty firm conclusion that these pieces were together, did line up.
I just think it's so cool. I mean, I just think that it's so cool that like science can do that, and that you did that, and that, you know, your education and like research brought a piece of the planet's history like solidly together. I just think that's such a cool thing to do. You mentioned Marie Birdland a couple of times in that explanation. Can you like talk a little bit about that? Like, what is Marie Birdland? Who was Marie Bird?
Sure. Well, Marie Birdland was first seen by humans in 1929 during the first expeditions of Richard Bird, who created Little America and went to Antarctica, explored Antarctica about four different times. So the geography is, it mostly borders Pacific Ocean, and it's actually the largest unclaimed piece of continent on Earth, this slice of Antarctica that's called Marie Birdland. The part that's special to geologists is about the third of it, this territory, that is exposed mountains. Most of it's buried in thick ice. But the area that's exposed mountains is about the size of California. But it wasn't fully explored until when it started in 1929, and then with subsequent expeditions and subsequent satellite photography, and started putting together the pieces of, this is Marie Birdland. So who is it? Who's Marie Bird? Well, as soon as the Bird expedition, the first one, saw the eastern edge of the territory, Bird knew he wanted to name it, because that's what explorers do. They name things they find. So he couldn't name it after himself, because that's bad manners. So he wanted to name it after his wife, Marie Bird, who was probably the only person, this explorer, Richard Bird, had a close relationship with. Probably the only person, even though he spent years and months in Antarctica with a lot of the same people. His wife was the person the most important to him and the one he was closest to. So he named it after her in February 1929. And it still remains unclaimed territory.
So, I mean, was he aloof? Was that what was known about him? I mean, it sounds like you would get really close with your group on an expedition to Antarctica.
I would say yes. I'm reading a book right now about his first expedition. And he's a very complicated character, lots of flaws, very driven, goal-driven. One of his goals was to be the first he took aircraft with him. That was the first. One of his goals was to fly over the South Pole, which had only been visited on foot in 1911 and 1912. So he was the first person to go to the South Pole, overfly it with his crew in 1929, right? But he came from a military background and really felt that he needed to be aloof to stay in command.
Now you're talking about his expedition and what their goals were. Yours was a research expedition, this one that you write about in Mighty Bad Land. Which, by the way, isn't that a play on Marie Birdland, Mighty Bad Land, the name of your book?
Absolutely, yeah, that is a play on word, just a nickname. So it's, but they both have the same initials, MBL, Mighty Bad Land, Marie Birdland. And Mighty Bad Land has two connotations. One, it's kind of like a joke, like a nickname joke. But it's a bad joke. The joke, because it's really a challenging, hard, bad place to work.
So, well, tell us about some of the things in your research that what you had to endure there.
Yeah, well, first of all, our expeditions were in the early 90s, and Bird's expeditions were in the 30s. So there's, you know, 60, 70 years of progress between the two. But there's one thing that doesn't change, that didn't change and still is the same. It's really hard. It's hard to work there. The weather is challenging. You have to be isolated. So you are on your own. You have to, don't forget a paperclip because you have to bring it. Nothing is supplied to you after you get dropped off, which is the way we did it. So it takes, you got to have some grit. Even though the aircraft are bigger and better to drop you off, we still didn't have communications to any place other than the McMurdo station, the base. We didn't have GPS. We didn't have satellite telephones. It's lonely. It was very lonely.
And weren't the weather conditions, I mean, it was supposedly summer in Antarctica, but the weather conditions, I found one, because you camped in small two-man tents, and the whole thing about the whiteout that you had to endure, just to me would have been so claustrophobic, and to me it was frightening reading, because you just can't see, you're stuck indoors 24 hours a day for I forget how many days in the book, but that just, you know, and it's the summer, you know, it was so strange and stark, the starkness of the land and the isolation really came through with what you wrote.
Well, that's, I'm glad to hear that it affected you that way, because Mighty Bad Land, part of the bad is weather. And the whiteouts, yeah, they're really disoriented, and they're very claustrophobic. And but the part of the weather that's really terrifying are the blizzards, because the winds can be really extreme. It can get really cold, and it can last days, and you're stuck in your tent. And one of the more several things during a blizzard I wanted to mention. First of all, are you safe in a blizzard, in an Arctic blizzard with, you know, gale force and hurricane force winds outside your tent? Yes and no. It depends on how well you've set up your tent. Like one of my colleagues, Christine, who's in Mighty Badland, went to took an expedition there, same place, a few years later. I wasn't with her. And they had a storm, a blizzard. And they had six people, three tents. And one of the tents blew away right off the people, was covering the people. And then just simply the wind got underneath the tent and blew it away. And there, two people were there looking up at the blizzard. And, you know, the windshield's probably, who knows what it would have been, minus 30, 40, minus 40. And so they had to immediately find another tent to go into and wait out the storm. So those are scary, right? Because if you haven't, and that's happened to me also, not in when I was in a different expedition. If you haven't set up your tent correctly, that's your life that you're playing with. The other thing about living in a tent there is the wind is pretty much blowing all the time, and it's noisy in a tent. It sounds like rifles being shot, you know, crack, 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 crack. And can't sleep without earplugs. That's when I started wearing earplugs. That experience taught me. And of course, eye shades, it's always light. So it's never dark.
So, I think that would be the hardest part for me, is the like kind of all day noon sun action happening 24 hours. I mean, it doesn't dim, right? It's just up.
It gets at noon, like it's high in the southern sky, like, but here in the northern hemisphere, at noon in Antarctica, the sun is high in the northern sky, and here where we are in the northern hemisphere, the sun is high in the southern sky. So it's opposite, because you're in the opposite hemisphere. And it does get lower at midnight, and the light does dim, the shadows do get long, so there's a sense of time of day, but it's never dark. So if you're trying to sleep, eye shades make sense.
Yeah, the other thing that I found interesting is, for people that are listening, this book also has some incredible photographs in it, that they were down there, where they were going. And I think I said this before, but the vastness of the land, you know, it's hard to tell distance and dimension because it's just all white. And then you'll see the peak of a mountain, a little bit of rock, a different color sticking out. And those little teeny black dots are people, you know, in the distance in the photo. But the brilliance of the blue skies, I mean, it was such contrast. Did that, what did you think of being surrounded by that on good days?
Yeah, well, first of all, the good days make you forget the bad days. And that's the problem. So you can drop your guard when you're feeling really good because the weather's so good. But you're right about the sky, because it's the air is dry. And the air is pure. There's nothing in it. It's super clear. So it's got a very peculiar cobalt color to it. And the expanse of ice My before the book was titled Mighty Badland, I had the title The White Ocean of Ice. I was using that for a while until I changed it. But it's just the thing when you stop and starting to think about what you're looking at, the expanse, the infinite expanse, it kind of almost makes your head hurt because it's just so hard to think about something that is so vast and so vacant and so untouched. It's hard to even think about it because we can't experience that close by anywhere in the civilized world.
Wyoming's kind of like that.
Pardon me?
Wyoming is kind of like that.
Yeah. There are places where you can get that idea. But in Antarctica, you know, over the horizon, it's the same. And over the horizon, it's the same. It's the same. It's the same. And it goes on and on for thousands of miles. It's the same. And it's just overwhelming to think about it.
I want to ask about your research team that you put together. I mean, Antarctica has a lot of things that could make a trip complicated. You're really remote. It's kind of a dangerous environment. I mean, you know, did you pick your team because they had special skills? I mean, there are six of you. Can you talk a little bit about that? What pulled you to certain people and, you know, what you guys needed to know to be successful out there in the literal middle of nowhere?
Yeah, that's important. Important to think about that. So there were six of us, but two of the six had to have training in mountaineering. And this is a requirement of the National Science Foundation. For every two scientists that are going into what they call the deep field, which is so isolated, there has to be one mountain guide, alpine guide. So we have four scientists and two guides, okay? So of the four scientists, the two, Dave and I, were the ones who put the project together. We put together the scientific questions in the agenda. So we had to then select two more scientists. Okay, but to go back to the alpine guides, we did an international search to find people who were experienced. And we found three candidates. Two were already booked. And the one that wasn't booked was Alistair Kane in the book, who is from Scotland. And he has training in the Alps, and he worked for the British Antarctic Survey in what's called the Antarctic Peninsula. So he was key. Then the second mountaineering guide was my friend Steve Tucker, who took a lot of photos in the book, by the way. And he was trained and experienced in mountaineering, but had not been to Antarctica. So the six of us, one had Antarctic experience, and Dave and I had an idea. And then we needed two more people, and they both came from UC Santa Barbara. One, his Steve Richard, was a person who had special skills in the types of rocks we expected to encounter. So we recruited him. And then there's a woman, Christine, who's a graduate student. And by this simply blind luck, this circumstance with her, was she was a brand new graduate student who had come to Santa Barbara from Arizona, University of Arizona, did not have a sponsor, which typically a graduate student needs a sponsor. So she was looking for projects, and I announced that we had an Antarctic project working on these types of rocks, which she had worked on in Arizona. and she had a master's degree. She also milked cows at dawn from her family farm. So I figured she had the scientific skill and the grit. And she needed a sponsor and she needed a project, and she was in.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like for that team, what sort of significant discoveries were made by you and the team?
Well, sure, I could talk about that for a long time and put people to sleep. But the main discovery I'll summarize it. So first of all, we pretty much nailed down that the ranges we worked on in Marie Birdland were of a similar origin to the ranges in New Zealand. So we could make a tie. The thing that really surprised me is, you know, when Gondwana broke up and these Zealandia pieces in New Zealand moved away from Marie Birdland, we expected that event would have made the mountains, but that's not true. What we found was instead, when Gondwana was together, that's when the mountains were made, not when it broke apart. So it's about a 20 million year difference in the history of those ranges. So that was a surprise, because then we had to think of a different plate tectonic scenario, not breaking up of Gondwana and moving apart. There was something that happened before that. Then they broke up and moved apart. And the parts that moved north into the Pacific sunk and are now known as Zealandia and New Zealand. So, and then Zealandia, that idea that I came up with, it's a very significant finding, not only because here's a continent, here's another continent that we didn't think about because it's underwater. I mean, most people think of continents as places you walk around on and drive on and live on, but that's not the way the geologist thinks. The geologist thinks about, What's this terrain made of? Is it made of rocks that are like the continent, or made of rocks like an ocean? So it's rocks like a continent. So just because it has water on it doesn't mean it's not a continent. The sea level goes up and down hundreds of feet. So that's not a definition of a continent. But it made a big difference, made a big impact on the nation of Zealand, this whole concept. And the New Zealand geologists took the notion of Zealandia and really made it work. They put together the data that really showed that the piece that New Zealand sits on for sure is continental. And that has consequences for what territory New Zealand can claim as for economic resources. So that made the territory that is under their economic umbrella much, much bigger than it had been before this light bulb went off, with mostly the New Zealand geologists. I mean, I knew it when I first thought about it, but then the New Zealand geologists really put it together, and now they have a bigger continent.
Well, they saw the nationalistic advantages of really going for it for their very small nation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, submerged area of their Zealandia is bigger than their continent, their territory above sea level, much bigger.
Now, you're the only person I have ever met in my life that has a mountain named after them. Tell us about that. Where is it? You know, how did this all come about?
Yeah. Early in the expedition, we started to travel to saddle and make satellite camps to do work in specific areas. And one of the areas we picked was at the foot of this mountain called Peak 1070. There was been recent reconnaissance mapping was done in the 60s by the USGS. So we knew something about the geography, It was pretty well done. And we knew this peak was there, and we knew that this would likely to have the rocks we were looking for. But 1070 means it's 1,070 meters elevation. That's what the name is. And it's very impressive. It's very massive. It stands out in the range of called the Fossick Range. And we camped there over Christmas week in 1989. And that's where we had our first blizzard experience. A really, really scary blizzard experience. So I didn't think that much of it, because my brain was so busy thinking about all other balls in the air. But my student, Christine, and another Antarctic student I had, also called Crisp, a man, Christopher, thought decades later that, 1070, why? That's kind of a useless name for a mountain. And one, Christine thinks, why don't I name it after the person who changed my life? After Leyendijk. And so she proposed it to, she and my other student, Christopher, who was on different expeditions, proposed it to the Board of Geographic Names. You can't randomly name things just because, you know, on whims. So the Board of Geographic Names, which is a U.S. government group, they then check with a group called the Antarctic Names Group. I forget their full name, full label. And then they sent out the proposal to different government agencies, like to the NSF, the Antarctic Names, then like NOAA, and then USGS, and then to Homeland Security, and then to CIA. They really want to make sure they're not naming a mountain after a terrorist. And so after they've gone through all those different steps and checks, and then the Board of Geographic Names accepted her proposal. It took about a year. She told me she was going to do it, and I forgot about it. And then as I explained in the book, my book, Mighty Badland, in the epilogue, the proposal was accepted, and she called me and told me the 1070 was renamed after me. And that just shows what'll happen if you treat people right.
Well, I think that's a really fabulous honor. And especially because how many more expeditions did you do down to Antarctica?
Well, let's see, expeditions where we were going into the deep field, you know, into the remote field. I did two more, one the next year. And then Christine and I joined a German expedition, which returned to nearby areas of Marie Birdland a couple years later. Then I started working offshore doing marine surveys from research icebreakers. And I did, let's see, how many of those did I do? Three. So that's six, right? Three plus three, six. And then I did two other experiments on the continent, which were out of a remote base. They weren't isolated deep field, but they were geophysical experiments I did. So that's what, eight. And then I made, last one I made was in 2010, 11, that'd be nine, right? And that was to a drilling expedition. We were doing preliminary surveys work prior to doing some drilling. And that was the last time I went.
Were all these in, like, still research for Zealandia?
No, the on-land expeditions, the first three ones were focused on Marie Birdland and Zealandia. The marine expeditions were focused on somewhat on plate tectonics of Marie Birdland, but also on climate change in deep time, not current, but climate histories recorded in seabed sediments. And then the last two experiments I did were connected to plate tectonics. And the drilling experiment, which is the last one, did not secure funding. It didn't happen. I did the preliminaries, but we did not get to do the drilling. So that's a long answer to your question.
That's okay. I only asked because Zealandia was just sort of recently recognized, and so it took a really long time. So I was just curious if you had to expand that research to prove your theory to have it be recognized as a continent kind of thing.
Let me fill in that blank. So what happened after I coined the name in a publication in 1995 is the projects I did after that were the marine surveys where I was looking for evidence of past climate change. But what was happening in New Zealand, where the New Zealand geologists were taking the idea, the concept, and they were doing the hard work to pin down the notion of what Zealandia was and is, and why it came popped back up on the radar, is from their work. They published work in 2017 of all the, you know, the deep work on the concept to make it solid. And so that's why it showed up on, I mean, it was quite remarkable the impact that had on media, for one thing.
Did you see effects of climate change when you were down there?
Yeah, in retrospect, I can say yes. So we were focusing on plate tectonics, right, for the first three expeditions. But the year before we went, James Hansen, climate scientist, had testified to Congress and warned the public about the Senate, I think it was, climate change. So some scientists started to think about it. But the things that happened that surprised me on that first expedition is how warm it got on occasion. I mean, it was cold. It was always below freezing. And when the wind blew, the wind chill was nasty. But sometimes it would be above freezing and there'd be slush around us. And of course, that's no fun because then everything is wet. And then in that one chapter in Mighty Badland where I talk about the travel up the glacier, we come across, we're backtracking on our trail that we made. And part of the glacier we had traveled over the week before was now all melted. It was running water and swamps. It had gotten so warm down at the bottom of that glacier that it simply had this water there, which is, that's pretty rare to find running water in the Antarctic. So in retrospect, I think, yeah, that probably wasn't a circumstance that was happening in the century or two ago that we ran across.
Does the ice sheet there, because I mean it's a continent, that's virtually an ice sheet, is that affecting the global sea level rise?
Yeah, that's not something today I'm working on, but that's where huge amounts of resources are being devoted to, is is, you know, you think of what is Antarctica? Antarctica is a continent, not too unlike one we live on, but it's piled with, you know, thousands of feet of ice, squished down from all that ice that's on top of it, a few miles thick in places. So in the past, when we were trying to find out from doing our marine surveys, we were trying to find out what the extent of the ice sheet was over the last 30 million years. You know, did it grow? Did it shrink? There should be evidence in the seafloor offshore right next to it, right next to Antarctica for that. And the answer is yes, it did grow and shrink. But what's going on now is scientists are monitoring the rate of discharge of ice from the ice sheet into the ocean. Because that means that, think about the ocean as a glass of water. Think of Antarctica as a few ice cubes. And you take those ice cubes and you put them in the glass of water. What happens to the water level in that glass? It goes up. So if you put one ice cube in, it goes up a little bit. You put two in, it goes up more. And if you put them in fast enough, before you know what's going on, the cup of water will overflow. So that's the idea about watching the discharge of ice in the glaciers of Antarctica, seeing how much is coming off and how fast it's coming off, and then trying to come up with predictions of the effect on future sea level from the process.
Has Antarctica always been covered in ice? I mean...
No.
No?
No. So one of the crucial evidences for the idea of continental drift, which is the precursor of plate tectonics, which was first proposed in the early 20th century, was a flora called Glossopteris, which is found in southern parts of many of the southern continents. Well, the early Antarctic explorers found Glossopteris fossils in the middle of Antarctica, close to the South Pole. So that says that two things. It says that since that's a flora that's similar to the southern continents, it says the continents were back together. But when they were back together, there were things growing. There were forests. And of course, now we know there's dinosaurs were there, et cetera, and so forth.
And so, now nothing grows there.
Right. The answer to your question is, about 35 million years ago, there was a sudden change in Earth's global climate, where it went from what we call the warm greenhouse Earth to the what we call the ice house Earth we live in now. And the Antarctic ice sheet started to form about 35 million years ago. And it took a million or so years to cover the continent. And then only more recently did the ice sheets in Greenland and the Northern Hemisphere form. So yeah, before 35 million, most of the Earth was ice-free except in the very highest mountains.
Well, that's so interesting. So like the whole planet was tropical.
Well, it depends on where you were. I mean, it would have been temperate in the Antarctic part of the world. But yeah.
That's crazy.
I have a question. With all of the things that you've learned and your expeditions and all of your studies, this book is also very personal because you really bring the readers right along with you. I mean, they're in the tent with you. You're writing your notes. You're dealing with people. It's very personal. It's not like a scientific book. from afar. You really pull us in. I was understanding virtually everything. You explained it in just straight ahead language, and it pulls you into the pace because something different was happening all the time. What would you like readers to take away from your story when they read it?
I think that, first of all, it's a look at how difficult it is to do work there today, even compared to the explorers. It's difficult. Secondly, I wanted to show science as something done by, you know, kind of regular people who have their own specialties and expertise. But they still have all the regular stuff that all us other regular folks have. And then I wanted to show, the personal challenges I had to overcome, my own barriers that needed to be met and crossed to do it, and then do it again. So it's kind of like a hero's journey model of literature, I think. And I don't really know how to write. So scientists don't know how to write. So I took classes on trying to learn how to write, and the local class. The emphasis was always don't hold back, tell the truth. So I found that when I started to do that, when I could make that transition, I had a real story. I had a real personal story. Everybody has one, but you can't have any secrets. You just can't. So yeah, that's my main objective was to show what real people do in tough circumstances. We all have tough things going on in our lives, and you know, a good memoir is written about pushing through them.
I think it was beautifully written for someone who claims they don't know how to write. So listeners, don't let Bruce turn you off to his own book, because it was beautifully written. You really feel the experience that I feel like not only Bruce has, but kind of the rest of the team too. I mean, even though it's obviously all Bruce's perspective, you get this kind of feeling of the aloneness and the pressure of that, and also how these six people work together 800 miles away from any help to be out there and get the research done and eat and, you know, figure out how to bathe and toilet and all of that. It's wild to think that you can live in the middle of nowhere, Antarctica, in a tent.
Yeah, that to me seems so challenging. And then like having to build your little outhouse out of ice for every time you made camp, and all the different things of burying the tent so it didn't blow up and, you know, the wind didn't catch it. I mean, just the little things that anybody who goes camping, you've had to maybe deal with some of that. Here you were in these extreme conditions having to do this. And I just saw how everybody, you know what it was to me though, even though there were some personality differences in that, everybody came together as a team. You were going for the goal. And that part of it, though everybody had their different sections of what was to be accomplished, even the guides, they were on the team. And that's what made it such an incredible story of a six people out in the middle of nowhere, because the guides were just as important in many parts of the story as what the scientists were doing.
Or more so in some situations.
Yeah, they were, and especially in dangerous situations when something went wrong, they were there and they were the ones who were able to help save you. And that made them such an intricate part.
Absolutely right. I hadn't thought of it the way you had described it. There were no renegades, which you can, that could happen. But, you know, there if somebody wanted to drop out, there wasn't a flight coming to get them.
No.
No, once you're there, you're there. I mean, there's no, I'm homesick.
Yeah, what were they going to do? Stay in the tent all day? I mean,
out.
I think also, I mean, you know, like Bruce's internal narrative through the book, which is the narrative of the book, is really vulnerable. I mean, you know, there was a level of vulnerability in that I was not expecting when I opened this book about research in Antarctica. I wasn't expecting this man to tell this story from this place of, you know, where sometimes it was sort of like, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if we're safe. I don't know, you know, if this weather is ever going to end, which I'm, you know, to me just felt like it was such an honest representation of what research out in the field must feel like to somebody who has never done that.
Thanks for that.
You know, it's really good. And it's made me think about a place I really, as I said in the beginning of this podcast, I'd never thought much about Antarctica.
Yeah, same
never
for me.
Crossed my mind. Never.
Except that I never want to go there. I mean, that's probably my biggest thought. And what do penguins do when it's winter? Because that, I mean, everything about Antarctica and the Arctic, I mean, both sides, I don't want to go there.
No, but you made it so special. And I think one of the things, not only in your writing, but having that incredible photography that illustrated what you were seeing, because I looked at one shot and I go, oh, there's a couple little hills. And then I realized those little, that's the team down there in the distance. I mean, that's not a little hill, you know, it's a mountain. And, you know, just the visuals helped with what you had written. I was getting them. And then to just see what it actually was, like, whoa, when I got to those pages, it was like, I was very excited about it because it just pulled it all into focus more.
Steve Tucker was, had the real, he had some high level training in photography. He took a lot of the photos that I think you like in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, he. Well, I don't know who took, you know, some of them his name was on, but yeah. The other ones you took too. I mean, but all of you, how much your faces got, you talked about getting burned in the wind on your faces, but when you see the photograph of these red, huge red cheeks and everything just from being there with, as you said, the constant wind, it really brought it home. So I thought that was a fabulous addition to the book.
I will say that the experience at Shackleton's cabin was a moment where I was like, man, I kind of want to go to Antarctica.
What was that like? You know, you write about it, but there you were in the cabin where you went into his, what had been his bedroom, office, whatever that was, of the man who inspired you to do all of this. What was that like to you?
I couldn't believe I was there. It just was like almost surreal, out of body type of experience. I mean, I don't know if I've never been to John F. Kennedy's grave, you know, in Washington, D.C., but it's maybe an experience like that. And to see and to be in that hut and to think about what these people were doing. They were up against things that nobody imagined, could have imagined, did imagine, nobody. And they did it anyway. It's just an astonishing experience. It really kind of floored me. I hope I betrayed that. I was totally floored.
Oh, you did. And look at it. It started you on a journey that ended up with you being there, going on so many expeditions down there. And now you have this wonderful book for us to read, Mighty Bad Land. And it comes out May 30th. I want everyone to, if you want to read a great memoir, first off, it's beautifully written, but just it'll take you to a place you have never been. And if you want to do that and see how real people made it through this, I highly, highly recommend Mighty Badland.
I do too.
Yeah.
Well, and thanks. I think that's the beauty of reading, right? As I mean, you can read something like this experience, you know, of Bruce's memoir and this very specific time period. I mean, it was 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Of their experience in Marie Birdland and their research. And it really takes you there. So if you've ever thought about Antarctica or haven't, this book will take you there in either case.
Another strange new world.
Yeah, right.
Well, I want to thank you, Bruce, for joining us and being on this episode of Talking Book Publishing. And as I said again, his book is Mighty Badland. It will be available everywhere May 30th. It's up for pre-order now. Thank you, Bruce, and look forward to hope we have very good success with the book.
Thanks so much.
Talking Book Publishing is brought to you by Writers and Publishers Network, a resource for writers and indie publishers at every level and offers tools to be successful in their writing career. Writers and Publishers Network.com.